Welcome back to Vital Minds, everyone. This is a podcast series brought to you by the PA Foundation, the philanthropic arm of the American Academy of PAs. The PA Foundation's mission is to empower PAs to improve health through philanthropy and service. We're connecting the most vital issues in clinical care with the top minds facing them every day. I'm James Millward, a PA myself, and your host for Vital Minds. In today's episode, we'll not only be diving into opioid and alcohol abuse, we're also providing an opportunity to earn CME credit through AAPA's Learning Central. After listening to today's podcast, be sure to visit pa-foundation.org, where you can learn how to earn CME credit just for listening. Now let's dive in. As we all know, the opioid crisis is a national concern. Over the past 15 years, individuals, families, and communities across our nation have been tragically affected by the opioid epidemic, and the number of overdose deaths from prescription and illicit opioids has risen to 42,249 in 2016, more than double the overdose deaths reported in 2010. As frontline providers, PAs have an opportunity to be part of the solution when it comes to treatment accessibility. I recently had a chance to speak with Dr. Joshua D. Lee, an associate professor of population health and medicine and general internal medicine and clinical innovation at the NYU School of Medicine. He is also the director of the NYU Fellowship in Addiction Medicine. Here's what he had to say about issues related to patient access to substance use disorder therapies.
Yeah, unfortunately, in the United States, it's not as easy to access or straightforward for most patients and families as we'd like. It's highly local. It's different city to city, county to county, state to state. Medicaid availability in general, and then what Medicaid covers, if you're otherwise kind of talking about poor and underserved populations, varies markedly in the United States, and it's a lot different in New York State, where I practice, what's available and covered than, for instance, Tennessee, where I grew up, which has less robust Medicaid coverage of addiction treatment services, and along with that, less availability per capita or in any given city, county, or zip code of what we think of as top-line most evidence-based treatments. If you're talking about opiate use disorders, you really should be thinking about accessing medications to maintain on opioids, but to do it safely and most healthily, you want to think about methadone maintenance and buprenorphine maintenance. Those are two approaches where you're going to maintain on opiates day in, day out. And while you will still be physically dependent on opiates, those two medications render people functional, relatively happy, with good energy, productive, and they both lock the usual activity of opiates like heroin or oxycodone, so that if people are in treatment, they're much less likely day to day, month to month, to continue to use or go back to using heroin or other opiates. And then there's also naltrexone products, in particular extended release naltrexone. That's for if people have detoxed off opiates and are really trying to pursue so-called drug-free, opiate-free recovery, where they're not going to be on methadone or buprenorphine. They do not want to go back to using opiates. And a once-a-month shot with naltrexone, which is a blocker of the opiate system, it's otherwise not a narcotic, can markedly increase people's chances of staying relapse-free over 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, however long that medication is going to be used. There's also counseling, of course, that's common to pretty much all forms of addiction treatment, alcohol, cocaine, opiates. Counseling is usually within an outpatient program. It could be through a private therapist. It could be in a so-called drug treatment program. It could also be the bulk of what goes on in rehabs or residential treatment centers, a lot of groups, a lot of one-on-one stuff with some type of licensed or credentialed counselors. When you think of AA and 12-step and peer support, that's also very important to a lot of patients, but that largely exists outside of so-called kind of treatment systems or healthcare systems. It's not covered by insurance. It's anonymous. Nobody knows you when. Stuff like that is typical of AA or Narcotics Anonymous. Very useful to a lot of patients, but also hard to really kind of quantify how many people wind up going, how much they go, how effective it is, kind of per session or per person. And it's a little looser and undefined how to recommend people use those services. But I generally recommend everybody consider 12-step involvement. Have a individual counselor or some kind of group counseling support. The more kind of professional and formalized that is, the better. But then also back to opiates, if people are just trying to do counseling and not pursuing medication treatment, whether it's naltrexone for relapse prevention or buprenorphine or methadone for maintenance of an opiate-dependent state that is still blocking the bad opiates like heroin and oxycodone, if you're not thinking about those three medications, you're really not getting anywhere close to the best possible treatment for this very serious and often fatal condition. It's really extremely important that people realize it's not enough just to say detox and go to outpatient and do the 12 steps. That does not work by and large for heroin disorders, which is kind of the current crisis in the United States. We have to use more of the three forms of medications that we have. They work well, and they work demonstrably, unequivocally much better than just doing counseling or behavioral treatment alone.
Addiction is a health concern we all want to be prepared to address, and access to treatment is a key area where PAs can play a very big role. Here to talk about it with me today is Christopher Ortiz, PAC. Christopher currently works at Column Health in Arlington, Massachusetts, treating patients with psychiatric disorders as well as providing addiction services. Before working as a PA, Chris worked in pre-hospital medicine as a paramedic, providing emergent, life-saving interventions in communities in the South and North Shore regions of Massachusetts. Chris, thank you so much for being with us today and bringing your expertise and experience into this very important issue.
Thanks for having me today, James.
Now, Chris, tell us what motivated you to work as a PA after working in pre-hospital medicine as a paramedic.
So my journey in medicine actually began after I graduated high school. I actually entered the seminary studying to be a Roman Catholic priest for several years. And after time, discernment, and prayer, I came to understand that my vocation didn't lie in the priesthood, but I drew a correlation between wanting to heal those spiritually and wanting to help those physically and mentally. So after obtaining my certification in paramedicine, I no longer wanted to limit my scope of practice to the back of the ambulance. So I decided to enter PA school. Given my history, my work will always be geared to those who have historically been marginalized by society. So those who have suffered from addiction, who are incarcerated, the Native American population, or the LGBTQ community.
That's very interesting. Now, you currently work with individuals to provide addiction services. When you consider the opioid crisis and substance use disorders in general, are you seeing an increase in the need for treatment?
Absolutely. As you previously mentioned, James, there were over 40,000 deaths in 2016. And when we look at the numbers and break it down to daily deaths, that's over 115 deaths a day from opiate use disorder. In 2016, there were over 64,000 deaths due to overdose, with the sharpest spike being that in fentanyl. In my office and during intakes and patients providing urine and analysis drug screens, it's very uncommon now that I see patients who have the metabolites for heroin or for other prescription pain medications. Unfortunately, it's very common that patients understand that they're using fentanyl. So before, when patients were using heroin, it was the idea that they were playing Russian roulette when every time that they used. Now, when patients either relapse or potentially go from prescription pain medications straight over to fentanyl, they're using a loaded gun, and their first time or the next time could be their last use.
That makes a lot of sense. Now, one thing that's interesting about the cycle of addiction versus other diseases is that there is such a stigma around it that makes patients afraid to ask for help. Do you find that all PAs, not those just specializing in addiction medicine, should be equipped to look for indications of substance use disorders?
Absolutely. All PAs should be aware of the current climate that we live in and should be aware of substance use disorders and how to identify them. But especially those PAs who work in primary care, because those are going to be our providers who can identify potential patients who could be at risk for developing substance use disorders. But other PAs as well who work in subspecialties such as oncology, surgery, where they might be prescribing opiates, it's going to be vitally important that they assess whether there's a history of addiction or risk factors that a patient could develop a substance use disorder.
Now, following up on that topic, are you also finding that there is a lack of accessibility to treatment for some patients?
So I'm fortunate in the sense that in working in Massachusetts, in the greater metro Boston area, that there is not a lack of accessibility. However, areas in which have been affected most by the opioid epidemic, areas such as Ohio, West Virginia, I can personally tell you that I have patients who travel from New Hampshire into Massachusetts because of lack of accessibility in the region. I recently was attempting to coordinate transference of care of a patient leaving my care and moving to another part of the country. And in doing so, I came to realize that the patient had to travel 50 miles one way to cross state line in order to access care. So there is definitely still issues with accessibility to treatment.
Definitely. Now, when I was talking with Dr. Lee, he shared that their research demonstrates that extended-release naltrexone is a treatment that's been proven effective for patients with opioid use disorders. What indications have you found, Chris, that exist for XR naltrexone, and how can PAs assess patient readiness for it?
So the two indications that exist for extended-release naltrexone are opiate use disorder and alcohol use disorder, as defined by a DSM-5. And in the DSM-5, when you look it up, there are 11 criteria that fall under the category of opiate use disorder and alcohol use disorder, both which can be interchangeable for the substance. And a patient has to meet two of the following criteria within a 12-month period. So if a patient were to come in and say, I have a concern that I have a problem. I'm not sure what I need to do about it. And then upon assessing and evaluating the patient, if in during the course of the interview, you discover that they have used despite legal consequences and then have continued to use despite physiological consequences, such as pancreatitis from alcohol abuse or endocarditis stemming from opiate use disorder, they meet the criteria for either opiate use disorder or alcohol use disorder. Now, when assessing readiness, a patient has to be highly motivated to undergo extended-release naltrexone treatment for opiate use disorder, 7 to 10 days abstinence from any sort of opiate in order to start treatment. And then they come back every 24 to 28 days for follow-up injections. That being said, because extended-release naltrexone isn't an antagonist, there is no physical dependency. So after several months, if a patient thinks that they're doing well, sometimes patients will go ahead and on their own decide to discontinue treatment without provider consultation. So a patient has to be highly motivated to continue treatment a certain amount of time prior to any treatment.
That makes sense. Now, what tools do you suggest clinically that PAs can use for assessing patients with opioid and alcohol use disorders?
Well, there are several screening tools that can be used in the primary care office. For alcohol use disorder, the most common ones are the CAGE and AUDIT-C. And so when a patient comes up for a follow-up for an intake, this is something that can be put in with an intake paperwork to kind of identify whether or not a patient may have an alcohol problem. And going along the same lines for opiates, the DAST-10 is a screening tool that can be used as well to identify whether or not the patient could potentially have not only problems with the use of opiates, but potentially other drugs as well.
Very good. Now, with treatment specifically, tell me a little bit more about the treatment process for extended-release naltrexone. How long does that usually last?
So treatment is highly variable and should really be tailored to the patient. I typically recommend at least 12 months of undergoing extended-release naltrexone treatment because for many patients, their use or abuse and physical dependency of whether it's alcohol or opiates, many, many years. And so to undergo at least a year of pharmacological treatment is highly recommended. Now, that being said, if a patient wishes to discontinue treatment or complete treatment, there are certain variables that I look for in a patient's readiness to complete treatment in order to really lower the risk for relapse, such as the abstinence from the use of other drugs, psychotherapy, mental health is being taken care of, and lifestyle changes, because alcohol and opiate use disorders envelop the whole patient's life. And so they have to change their lifestyle. It's just not the physical dependency. It's the behavioral aspects as well. So if a patient continues to associate with known drug dealers, lifestyle and habits, they're at increased risk for relapse. Those are the variables that I look for when a patient is ready to complete treatment.
Dr. Lee has also conducted several clinical trials examining the use of naltrexone and sublingual buprenorphine treatments. Here's what he had to say about the treatment process.
Yeah, one of the most interesting and generalizable and most recent large U.S. trials compared extended-release naltrexone to buprenorphine naloxone film. It recruited adults who were already showing up to 8 detox centers around the country for opiate treatment, and then it asked them if they were interested in being part of a trial. Naltrexone in this form is given as a monthly shot after people have completed detox, whereas with buprenorphine, folks take it every day. They put, in this case, film or 2 pieces or 3 pieces of film under their tongue. It dissolves, and they do that every day at home. And they don't have to complete detox. They're able to start on buprenorphine pretty much the next day after using any other opioids or upon first showing up for treatment. So this study, when it ended, had treated 570 people, again, around the country. Half had been assigned to naltrexone, half had been assigned to buprenorphine. It found that naltrexone up front is much harder to start on people that are in a detox unit or have just come into treatment having been regular daily users of heroin, which was characteristic of most of the people in the study. And it's harder to start because people have to get through the initial detox period, which can take a week or two and may involve some discomfort, and people may get bored and they got to stay motivated, which doesn't always happen. And only then, after about a week after the last use of opioids, do you generally think it's safe to start the initial dose of naltrexone. Whereas with buprenorphine, typically we start it in the doctor's office or in an outpatient program where people are currently using other opiates like heroin. They want treatment. They're told to start buprenorphine when they first experience a little bit of opiate withdrawal, and then they can start buprenorphine and keep on it day in, day out in a maintenance program. So that's what people did in this trial as well, and it was quite easy to get almost everybody onto buprenorphine, whereas about 70% only of the naltrexone group was able to start the medication in the first place. Once people were on both medications, they did actually very similar. So they're two very different approaches to be on a opiate blocker, that's naltrexone, which is not a narcotic. You're no longer on opioids and you have to take this injection once a month, or to be on a long-acting opioid, which is buprenorphine. It's not something that intoxicates people. People can be kind of clear-headed and functional and do very well over time, but they are remaining on an opiate medication. So it's an interesting study because these are two very different medications pharmacologically. Naltrexone is a opiate antagonist or a blocker of the opiate system. It is not a narcotic. So after detox, once you go into naltrexone, it's basically kind of putting a force field around the part of your brain where heroin would work, and it prevents any heroin from getting in there and having any effects. And so people generally use very little opiates of any kind while they're on naltrexone. They're also, when they stop the medication, there's no opiate withdrawal because they're already off and completely undependent on opiates. Whereas buprenorphine, like methadone, is an opiate maintenance approach. So buprenorphine itself is what we call an agonist or a active opiate compound at the opiate receptors in our brain. It tends to be very long-acting, very boring. People generally don't feel sedated or high or really kind of altered psychoactively. And it also is very sticky at the opiate receptor, so it blocks the effects of heroin, not unlike naltrexone. So they're two very different approaches. One, you get off opiates and stay off opiates. Two, you stay on opiates, just a healthier, kind of medically approved opiate. Both of them are going to reduce cravings, the overall use of heroin, protect against overdoses, and help people get back to healthy, functional lives if people stayed in treatment. And the rates of people staying in treatment were about the same after they had started. Overall, because fewer people had gotten onto naltrexone in the first place, there was a lower overall rate of what we looked at as a primary outcome in the study, which was relapse-free survival for the naltrexone group, people that had not been able to start it in the first place. Almost all of those participants had a early opiate relapse, that is, they were lost or they had gone back to using opiates relatively rapidly, whereas there was a lower rate of that early on in the buprenorphine group due to more of those people being able to start the medication in the first place. But then when we looked at everyone that had started both medications, they actually, again, looked very similar. So this trial was written up and I think covered in the media as a relatively successful trial for the newer of the two medications, that is, extended-release naltrexone. It was relatively effective and useful in a large majority of the patients randomized to it in the study. There's clearly some kind of logistical and induction difficulties with naltrexone that you do not have with buprenorphine. And so it's a mixed bag, but we thought it was a good study in that it really showed the two side by side. We'd never had a study that big in the United States. It applies to pretty much all patients who might be considering these two medications. This study can tell them a lot about what to expect when they are in treatment. And both medications are quite safe. We found that there were very low rates of overdoses, both non-fatal and any deaths from overdose, while people were on both medications. But if people were not on the medications, there were higher rates of overdose events. And that's an important lesson, really, for public health and for individual patients. Whichever medication, methadone, buprenorphine, or naltrexone people are considering, you really are in a safer zone or space when you're on those medications. And whenever you get off, whether it's carefully and with skill or if it's haphazardly and you just kind of drop out of treatment from 1 month to the next, you go back to a very risky period or environment where you're not protected by these medications. And use of opiates is quite dangerous now in the age of fentanyl. And we see that time and time again in studies like this. People are not able to continue treatment. We really should think of it as long-term maintenance treatment in almost all cases. They're going to eventually have to face higher risks of relapse if the treatment is discontinued.
Thank you, Dr. Lee. Now back to you, Chris. One thing to consider with this treatment are the potential side effects. What are some of the most common side effects you've seen with XR naltrexone, and why is it so important to discuss these things with our patients?
It's vitally important that we discuss the side effects with patients because it could potentially inhibit and hurt the relationship that we have with our patients, which will directly and consequently affect their treatment. The most common side effect that is experienced with extended release naltrexone is that of gluteal soreness at the injection site. Typically lasts from 3 to 5 days. I recommend ibuprofen 800, warm compress, massage the area. Other side effects include lethargy and headaches. Typically, they last a week and then dissipate. I have a very few patients, a minority, in which the headaches and lethargy last the whole month. And then it's a matter of assessing whether or not it's efficacious versus the side effects. Are the side effects manageable by over-the-counter medications? Or are they so impairing that it affects the patient's day-to-day life? If that's the case, then alternative treatment plans should be formed.
Now, of course, naltrexone is not always the best option for every patient, as you mentioned. What alternatives have you found that exists that PAs should be aware of?
So for treatment for opiate use disorder, methadone is a full agonist, which is a treatment option, which is FDA approved. And patients present over to an opiate treatment program for daily dosing. And then as long as the patient does well, remains abstinent from the use of other drugs, attend psychotherapy, they quote unquote gain privileges and take home privileges and can go home with more dosages and then only in return to the OTP once a month. Buprenorphine is another option for patients, which is a partial agonist and can be dispensed and prescribed at outpatient offices, primary care clinics as well. And so those are the two FDA-approved medications for opiate use disorder. For alcohol, disulfiram, which inhibits the metabolism of alcohol, is another FDA-approved medication, as well as etamprosate, which is a medication which works on the glutamate neurotransmitter and helps with the urge and cravings for alcohol, and it's dosed 3 times daily.
Now, Chris, what about providers who don't offer treatment for substance use disorders? Many of us specialize in different things that don't really address substance use disorders on an everyday basis. Are there any national referral resources that listeners should know about?
So the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration is a great resource that any provider can access along with the public. This website has information regarding grants, new campaigns, programs. It can also help with identifying special populations, so pregnancy, adolescents, and treatment programs for those special populations as well.
Very good. And Chris, for the PA students listening in, can you draw from your experience to give a single piece of advice for working with patients suffering from substance use disorders?
For maybe two, it would be to listen and to be kind. These disease states are not like a patient coming in being assessed for mild hypertension or for kidney stones. These diseases envelop the patient's entire life, the emotional, spiritual, psychological, physiological aspect. And so when these patients come in, they want to be heard. They want to be cared for. This is something that they've been outcasted by society with a stigma. So if we can do that for them, if you listen, be kind, they'll buy into your treatment plan much more so if you can do these two things for these patients.
That makes a lot of sense. Kindness is such an important part of patient care. Chris, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a great conversation about a very important topic. For our listeners, be sure to visit the PA Foundation website for additional resources, like the research article Dr. Lee and his colleagues published. And in order to receive your CME credit, visit AAPA's Learning Central site. Eager to hear more? Be sure to catch all our Vital Minds episodes at pa-foundation.org. Support for this episode of Vital Minds is provided by NIDA, the National Institute on Drug Abuse Clinical Trials Network Dissemination Initiative. Until next time, everyone, I'm James Millward, and this is Vital Minds.